54 million Americans live with some kind of disability. While much progress has been made, advocates for the disabled say much more needs to be done. Welcome to Open Line. I'm Mike Thompson. Fred Anderle is off today. This week, Columbus is the focus of the disabled community and their advocates as the city hosts a national forum on disability issues this weekend. The forum will look at the Americans with Disabilities Act, or ADA, which is now 18 years old. We'll discuss in this hour living with a disability, caring for somebody with a disability, and the many policy issues associated with the ADA and with disabled folks. Our guests this hour are Sue Hetrick, co-chair of the Ohio Disability Vote Coalition. Sue, welcome to Open Line.
Thank you, Mike.
Scott Listener, he's the Ohio State University's ADA coordinator. Welcome, Scott.
Thank you, Mike.
And joining us on the phone, Judy Woodruff, PBS NewsHour senior correspondent, and she is the moderator of this weekend's Forum on the Disabled. Judy, welcome to Open Line on WOSU.
Thank you, Mike. I'm delighted to join you.
Our phone number is 292-8513, 292-8513. We welcome your phone calls. We especially want to hear from you if you are disabled, if you are caring for somebody who is disabled and you're struggling to cope with obstacles at your job or at other places in the community, or if you're a business owner or an organization owner or operator trying to comply with the ADA and some of those things. Please give us a call at 292-8513. Or you can email us at openline@wosu.org. Sue Hetrick, let's start with you. ADA, 18 years old. Doesn't seem like it's been that long since that law was passed. People, I take it, are better off. Disabled people are better off than they were 18 years ago.
I believe they're better off than they were 18 years ago. I think we've made a lot of progress and have a way to go.
What was for those of us who don't remember what it was like before ADA, what with some of the things we now take for granted that that law put in place?
Well, we can expect physical access to buildings. We can expect access to programs that we didn't previously have. Accommodations to ensure that people with disabilities can be employed. Scott, you can answer some of that too, I'm sure.
You're in charge of making sure that Ohio State complies with ADA.
Yes, I am, and it's a big job, but I think we do a reasonably good one. I would answer that question best with a really short example or story.
Sure.
A young woman many years ago who started public school in Brooklyn in New York and was told that because she was in a wheelchair, she would be a fire hazard to the other students if there was a fire drill and that she shouldn't go to public school. She eventually did go to school and finish college and get a degree in teaching. And was told when she showed up for her medical exam after being accepted as a teacher and passing the licensure exam, the doctor said, wait a minute, you're in a wheelchair. You can't be a teacher. That won't work. She eventually became the Assistant Secretary for Special Education and Rehabilitation Services under President Clinton, Judy Heumann. So that's, I think, a good mark of the difference between then and now.
So it moved the physical barriers, but also it has helped to break down the stigma and the emotional barriers and the mental barriers that people had when they saw a disabled person, that
absolutely
this person cannot do the job. Judy Woodruff, you must have covered the battles over ADA 18 years ago, or at least were monitoring as a journalist and a network correspondent. Do you remember those debates?
I do. I was not covering the Congress at the time. I was then working where I am now, actually. I went away to work for CNN for about a dozen years, but at the time I was working for the NewsHour, what was then the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour on PBS, and those debates garnered, a huge amount of attention. And, you know, it's interesting. These issues just seem to come back to us every year because, as Sue and Scott have just pointed out, there's been a lot of progress made, but there are still hurdles to be overcome. And I'm really part of this right now because I have a son who's 26 years old who's been profoundly disabled for the last 10 years since he was 16 when he suffered a brain injury that left him significantly disabled. He's in a wheelchair and has vision and physical and speech and memory impairments. And it's remarkable as a family member of someone in that situation to see what they can do and what they are not allowed to do because of the advances because of ADA, but also because of what society still, you know, has not worked out.
292-8513, 292-8513. If you'd like to join our guests, Sue Hetrick, co-chair of the Ohio Disability Vote Coalition, Scott Listener, Ohio State University's ADA coordinator, and Judy Woodruff, PBS NewsHour senior correspondent and the moderator of a forum this weekend in Columbus on disability issues, in which both presidential candidates are expected to at least address the crowd, if not take questions. They'd probably just address the crowd via videotape.
Right? Well, just to clarify that, John McCain will be participating by satellite. Yeah. He's going to be at his home, I believe, in Arizona. Mm-hmm. Senator Obama is actually flying back from his trip to the Middle East and Europe on Saturday, so he's not able to participate. Yes. But Senator Tom Harkin of Iowa will be there in person as a surrogate for Senator Obama.
So this still is a big issue, 54 million Americans living with a disability. So what more needs to be done? What are the other things that we have? We've had ADA. It's better than it was 18 years ago. Some of the stereotypes are being broken down. What's the biggest challenge that remains?
I think the biggest challenge is still attitude, mm-hmm. and to some degree education. We continue on a very basic level. You would think that you could go into any building now, especially new construction, and find it accessible. But the fact is we walk into brand new buildings all the time and find inaccess under the ADA. Either people, the architect, the construction manager, the owners aren't aware, or they're misinformed, or they think for some reason they don't need to comply. Mm-hmm. So on a very basic level, physical access is still a problem, but those attitudes are still in place as well.
Is it a code enforcement issue? I mean, how is the information not getting to the contractor in the terms of construction?
I suspect it's not as simple as a code enforcement issue, but I think that is part of it, mm-hmm. Understanding who is covered and who isn't covered. States can have their building code pre-approved as being equivalent or better than the standards under the ADA. And if Ohio did that, has not done that yet. Some states have. I think that helps, mm-hmm. because it means there are fewer sources to go to and ask, am I doing it right? We've been working really hard with our College of Architecture to do more and more in training of new designers. And I think that's been a big issue historically, is just getting them to have that as part of the planning process from the early on, and making it a part of their education along with the other aspects of design.
Is it getting easier and easier? People, I mean, some buildings, most builders know this is the law now, and you have to have these things, and it's not as much of a struggle, or is it still a struggle?
I think overall, most buildings are. I think mm-hmm. it's still a bit of a struggle. I think there are particular industries that are problematic. So apartment complexes have not quite yet figured out what jurisdiction under the Fair Housing Act sure. requires access, and there's a lot of issues with accessible housing. I think public buildings tend to be done a fair amount better. Governments and state agencies have kind of figured that part out. Mm-hmm. And then there's a lot of housing stock and building stock that is just old, and I think figuring out what happens during a renovation has been one of those areas that has not been particularly well promoted educationally for contractors in continuing education kinds of settings, or done well by plans examiners sure. and the building board folks.
Judy Woodruff, from your perspective, what needs to be done? What else remains in this area as far as offering equal opportunities to folks who are disabled and equal access?
Well, the physical barriers are certainly a huge part of this, because you can imagine the things that the rest of us take for granted, being able to go into any building, any shop, any home, and not thinking twice about getting in upstairs and so forth. For people who are disabled, who are physically disabled, and obviously we're talking about a whole range of mm-hmm. kinds of disabilities, you know, visual and other types of impairment, hearing. So we want to cover the everything here. But there still is for those who are disabled a whole world that they don't have access to. But I would add to that the barriers to education and employment. Our son, for example, we looked all over the country for colleges that could handle a student who needed, who needed more than the typical student in the way of needing round-the-clock nursing care that we were prepared to pay for, and the vast majority of colleges around the country don't offer that kind of option. That's been a huge disappointment to us and to many, many other families we've come across in the last number of years. And the other, I would say, is employment. I was just reading the Wall Street Journal just this week, and it said, it pointed out that, you know, even though there's something like 22 million working-age Americans with disabilities who have come of age under the ADA, today only 38% of the nation's working-age disabled have a job, compared with 78% of able-bodied people. So that tells us something about the barriers that still exist in employment. And again, I would add to that education.
So you had a comment. Sue Hedrick?
I did. I think along with that, Judy, is the whole issue goes hand in hand with poverty and income. We have 27.5% of people with disabilities in the United States live in families with incomes below the poverty line. Only 8.8% of people without limitations in the same age range live in families with incomes below the poverty line. So there's a great disparity, and there's a lot of reasons for that. I need to add, too, that something that goes hand-in-hand with the ADA and access is the whole issue of institutionalized care. There was a Supreme Court decision called Olmstead several years ago that said under the ADA that people could not be unnecessarily institutionalized because there weren't funds available, there weren't places for them to go or supports. So there's that whole issue of institutionalizing people versus not. And of course, once they are out of the institution, as Judy said, the issue of employment or accessible housing comes into play.
How do you convince an employer to hire or to at least seriously consider someone with a disability?
Go ahead, Judy. No, I was just going to say very briefly, there's so many, one thing we need to point out is there's so many different types of disabilities. Mm-hmm. I mean, they range from hearing impairment to mild visual impairment mm-hmm. to severe, all the way to, you know, for people who may have lost part of a limb, all the way to those who can't walk at all and who are relying on wheelchairs. I mean, they're just such a range. And so you can't lump them all together. But I would say, you know, it takes acquainting the employer with the assets of that employee, of making sure employers know that some employees are good at some things and less good at other things. And I just think it takes a consciousness on the part of the employer.
And some employers need to understand how to give that person appropriate support. We're talking about physical access, but as Judy said, there are people with all kinds of disabilities. I happen to have a son with Down syndrome, so he needs other kinds of support to access employment, some kind of special understanding.
I think part of it is sharing with employers the statistics. Individuals with disabilities tend to stay on the job longer. They find a home that works for them, and they want to stay, so to speak. There is tax incentives from the federal government for making your workplace more accessible and for doing certain kinds of hires. There's a statistic out there that the average workplace accommodation costs between $500 and $650 for an employee. That's less than running an ad and doing a search for a new person. Yeah. So there's a lot of basic information I think employers are missing. And I think the other piece goes back to both the educational systems and the disconnects between systems that we have as you move from K through 12 that is principally covered by IDEA to college that is covered by the ADA in Section 504. There's some system disconnects in that transition that we've been working on for a long time and still need a fair amount of work. And then colleges are working on that transition from college to employment, and that's a piece that colleges haven't paid really good attention to until the last 5 or 6 years.
292-8513. If you'd like to join our guests, they are Sue Hetrick, co-chair of the Ohio Disability Vote Coalition, Scott Listner, he is Ohio State University's ADA coordinator, and Judy Woodruff, the PBS NewsHour senior correspondent, also a moderator of a disability issues forum this weekend in Columbus. Let's go to the phone, and Bob, you're on the air. Go ahead, Bob.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm disabled, and all my life I studied public policy. When I worked in Washington once, I stood in line behind Judy, but I didn't bother her. I felt she was deserved of privacy. My question is, after years of all this, everybody out there, or it seems as though the rules are made for particular people, and if I go out and check on them, on what benefits I'm entitled to or which ones I'm not, I feel personally that I'm putting myself in jeopardy of losing the benefits that I have qualified for because of something I didn't know that I couldn't do or didn't know that I shouldn't have done or something else. And I'm worried, especially now at a time when the country can't afford to have people not working if they can work, that if I do anything in particular, like people will say, oh, you're disqualified completely. And I just don't feel as though the rules are set up to make life easy for me. So, I'm constantly worried about all these things. I'm not cheating anyone because I'm disabled, but I don't know what else. But I think I could do more than sit at home too. I guess you can hear my voice.
So. Yes, Sue Hetrick, you have a response.
There are a couple things. The bad news is that yes, that is the case. The good news is that in Ohio we've passed a law called Medicaid buy-in where individuals with disabilities can work and then buy back into their Medicaid. They're not penalized for working. On the federal level, we've been working for years on passing what was called the MICASA. Now it's called the Community Choice Act, which is the same kind of concept. The people get the supports and services that they need based on need, but they're not penalized for working or going to school to pay for the supports that they need.
So here's a person who wants to live independently.
Exactly.
But is afraid that he would
lose Medicaid benefits by having income at the beginning stages before you have worked your way up the employment ladder to the point where you don't need those benefits for insurance and for other things.
I think we have a long way to go, too, on those providers who give advice or provide those benefits and educating them. It's been my experience with my son that it's more of a don't ask, don't tell policy if you don't know the questions to ask. So it behooves everyone and every family member to, unfortunately, have to become experts in those kinds of policies, too.
Bob, you still there?
Yes.
Anything else?
But I wasn't prepared. Let me just drop off. Okay,
all right.
Go ahead. Thanks for
taking
me.
I just want to say to Bob, I'm glad you called in, and I wish you had tapped me on the shoulder because I would have been delighted to talk to you wherever we were.
All right.
Thank you. Very kind.
And one last word to Bob. If you have those kinds of questions and you don't want to ask from the program providers that you're talking to, I would encourage you to look up your local independent living center. They are a group that would be happy to help you figure out where the rules are.
Okay.
Sure. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob. Good luck to you.
Thanks.
292-8513 if you would like to join in our discussion. We're talking about issues involving the disabled and disability policymaking in the 18th anniversary of the ADA. The difference between a physical disability and non-physical disability, or at least non-evident disabilities, whether it be learning disabilities or disabilities that restrict a person's ability to think. That has to be that we all see the ramps, and we know when someone's in a wheelchair. But the disabilities that aren't quite as obvious, there still has to be a lot of work to be done there. I would assume.
There definitely is. Mm-hmm. It's a little less obvious. You don't get that day-to-day exposure. The educational system helps that some. I think there's a lot out there in terms of efforts to help that. Those are actually in many ways the kinds of accommodations that we work out in the classroom or in the workplace that in some sense, should be quickest and easiest and are the most difficult because people have trouble breaking habit, have trouble thinking differently than they've thought in the past.
Judy Woodruff, just a few minutes left before you have to leave us. As you prepare to moderate this this forum, what do you hope people bring away from it? What do you hope that the politicians bring away from it?
Well, I think it's just at a very basic level. I think it's so important for all Americans, and especially Americans with disabilities, to know that their leaders, the two men who would be president of the United States or their surrogate, can indicate that they understand that these are real issues and serious issues that deserve their attention. I have the sense over time that so often the disability community has to stand outside a building still and beat the drums and march and so forth to get attention. I just so often have felt that our political leaders have not been aware of the problems and haven't done, I think, enough to educate themselves. And so I think the fact that both Senator McCain, who'll be participating by satellite, and the fact that Senator Obama, you know, has a surrogate there in Senator Harkin, the fact that they're there, that they're participating, that they're prepared to answer questions, I think just that act in and of itself is of enormous significance. Of course, I'm going to try to pin them down as much as I can on some of the issues that are alive today. There's an amendment to the ADA, for example, that's before the Congress right now. Mm-hmm. Talk to them about that. But in general, I'd just like to get their knowledge of you know, what is it like for people with disabilities. We know Senator McCain, you know, has experienced his own disadvantages because of his serving as a prisoner of war, and we know he has physical disabilities himself. And I'd be interested to know, you know, from the Obama side, from Senator Harkin, what is it that's the understanding of not only Senator Obama, but what are his intentions if he's elected president with regard to paying attention to issues that have to do with those with disabilities.
Okay. Judy Woodruff, thanks very much for joining us here on WOSU 820 as we discuss disability issues in the forum. It's a national forum on disability issues. It's this Saturday. It's based in – it's being run here in Columbus, and it'll be simulcast on the web. And we will put the web link for this forum on our website, wosu.org/openline. So if folks want to watch in, they can do that.
Thank you very much, Mike. I'm really looking forward to coming back to Columbus.
Thank you, Judy. And we'll take a break here on Open Line on WOSU 820. When we come back, we'll look at the amendment to the ADA, which is now before the Senate. The House has approved it, and we'll talk more about disability issues with Sue Hetrick, co-chair of the Ohio Disability Vote Coalition, and Scott Listener from Ohio State University's ADA office. When Open Line continues on WOSU 820, NPR News.
Next time on Day to Day, what do you do if your dog can no longer go for a walk? Leslie Grinnell and her husband got creative.
He went down in the basement and made her a set of wheels.
Now, their pet prosthetic has spun into a thriving manufacturing business.
People said, we have to take control over our own economic destiny, and small business was the way to go.
Putting pets and a small town back in motion. Next time on Day to Day.
Day to Day begins in 30 minutes, starting at noon, right here on WOSU 820, NPR News. Good morning, I'm Amy Jurevich. It is 78 degrees at 11:30. Thanks for joining us for Open Line. Get perspective on all the day's news with All Things Considered and the latest business news on Marketplace. Weekdays starting at 4, now on WOSU 89.7 FM. And WOSU Public Media presents Jazzu's Big Band Bash, featuring Helen Welsh with the Columbus Jazz Orchestra. Come swing and dance to the biggest hits from Glenn Miller, Benny Goodman, Duke Ellington, and Louis Armstrong, and the big band era. This Friday, July 25th at 8 p.m. at the Columbus Zoo. For more information, visit jazzartsgroup.org. And we hope to see you there this Friday at 8 p.m. In the weather forecast for today, a chance of a pop-up shower or thunderstorm throughout the day, a high of 85. Mostly cloudy tonight with scattered showers and thunderstorms, a low of 62. Sunny on Wednesday and a high of 82. And now back to Open Line.
Welcome back to Open Line. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Fred Anderle this morning. We are discussing issues involving the disabled, policy issues, just, you know, coping issues and some of the struggles that folks with disabilities still face, even though the American with Disabilities Act has been in place now for 18 years. Our panel, our guest this hour, Sue Hetrick, co-chair of the Ohio Disability Vote Coalition, and Scott Listener. He is Ohio State University's ADA coordinator. He makes sure that all the buildings for students and buildings for employees are ADA compliant and helps the university, a large organization, obviously, deal with that law. 292-8513, 292-8513 is the phone number to call if you'd like to take part in our discussion. Let's go to those phones. Jenny has been waiting patiently. Jenny, sorry to keep you waiting. You're on the air.
Hello? Do you mean Julie?
Julie, sorry.
Yes, that's okay. Thank you for taking my call. I worked for the current governor of Kansas when she was running for insurance commissioner, and she's also the daughter of Governor Gilligan, and she was trying to get in place the where mental disabilities were equal to physical reciprocity. Is that what it's called? I don't know what it's called. Anyway, she got it for the state workers, and I'm talking about psychiatric illness. My question is, I suffer bipolar, and I had the privilege of getting treatment out in Kansas and have the privilege to continue paying for very good treatment. I'm also a social worker, and I guess my question is twofold. The mental health centers are flooded, and as I work for an organization, it took they put on people on waiting lists for a year. So I'm a little concerned about that in Columbus. And the other thing I'm concerned about is why, and I've worked with clients who are trying to get on disability for psychiatric illness, takes forever. I could never get it for them, or they would be not denied, and then they had to appeal it. And by that time, they were so compromised, it was almost pointless. So anyway, that's my concern and question. Living here in Columbus as a social worker, I'll take my answer off the line.
Thank you, Julie.
Mm-hmm.
Who wants to take that one? The maze of funding and getting benefits.
Well, it is a difficult maze, and. We talked earlier about the difficulty with kind of the non-evident and non-physical disabilities. And the ADA itself is really about tolerance for difference and equity and won't directly address those issues of insurance funding and some of the other issues that the caller raised. I assume she's talking about Social Security disability benefits or private carrier disability benefits as the disability benefits. And I don't have a ready solution. I would encourage her to call into the forum and send a question. That's a broad policy question that I don't have an easy solution for. I think parity for mental health conditions with the same caps that physical conditions have rather than lower caps for treatment would certainly be a first step towards addressing a number of those issues for those that have private insurance carriers.
I think, again, what our policymakers don't understand, that this does become an issue of self-sufficiency, back to the employment issue, that in turn, if we provide these kinds of supports and services at the right time, then it makes the person a more productive tax-paying citizen in the end, too, if they're able to do that. Mm-hmm. So it comes full circle, and again, it's an education process for our policymakers.
292-8513 if you'd like to join in our discussion with Sue Hetrick, co-chair of the Ohio Disability Vote Coalition, and Scott Listener, Ohio State University's ADA coordinator. We're talking about disability issues because there is a national forum on disability issues taking place in Columbus on Saturday. John McCain will participate via satellite. Barack Obama is sending a surrogate because he's traveling back from the Middle East. So you're getting the attention of the national campaigns. You're also trying to get disabled folks out to vote.
The purpose of the campaign is twofold, to get interest generated in those policy issues. As much we want to encourage people with disabilities to get out there and vote and be counted, don't appear on any polls, no significant clout or political power, and we're trying to change that across the country. One of our co-sponsors of this event is the American Association of People with Disabilities, and we form these coalitions across the country in every state of people with disabilities voting and finding ways that we can account for their numbers. The only way we're going to develop that political power to really put disability issues on the forefront is to have that political power. It's either money or voting. And people with disabilities traditionally don't have the money, so they need to get out there and vote.
If you want to classify folks with disability as a minority, it's a large group of people.
It's the largest minority in the country.
Okay. And Scott, listener, you were saying that the access to voting booths and voting polling places is an issue that the state of Ohio is trying to address.
The Secretary of State, the Ohio Secretary of State's office, Jennifer Bruner's office, has appointed a coordinator to do lead work on trying to move both, ensure that polling places are accessible, ensure that boards of elections are working with equipment that is fully accessible for those who are blind or who have physical disabilities, and working on both voter education and polling worker education to make sure they know how to work with individuals with disabilities.
Okay. Let's go to the phones. And Beth, you are on the air. Go ahead, Beth.
Hi. Actually, I was calling because I've listened to many of these shows, and one thing that I haven't heard discussed is the fact that my husband's visually impaired and he receives disability. And he has great difficulty getting a job that would provide better benefits, would provide better pay, because if he goes just a little above what the government will allow him to make, he loses all of his disability.
That's what the earlier caller said, that this is kind of a catch-22.
Right. I think it really makes it so that it prohibits people with disabilities from being able to be productive, more productive members of society, and to be able to not be on disability. I mean, it's really a frustrating situation to be in.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Beth.
Thank you.
Same advice as earlier. Just make sure you know the rules. There are organizations out there. The Center for Independent Living is one that helps you negotiate the rules of Medicaid funding, and so you don't lose your benefits but still can live independently and try to advance in your career.
And the larger picture is forcing those policymakers, the lawmakers, the legislators, to understand that and change policy, so that's not the case.
The one thing that's before Congress now, the House has passed it, the Senate is considering it. It's the ADA Amendments Act. Now, this act followed several Supreme Court decisions, which tightened the ADA and restricted how it would be applied. It changes the definition of a disability. Now, it goes from substantially limits to materially restricts a person from performing a major life activity. Scott Listener, what's the difference there?
The difference is really a term of art in the court. So, you know, part of my introduction to this would be that material limits is a phrase the courts are very used to dealing with. It is contextualized. They do it in liability law. They do it in other areas of law. So it does have a meaning to the judges. The ADA amendments have done a very good job of anchoring that to some boundaries by specifically pointing to two sets of court cases in the amendments themselves. Toyota v. Williams and the Sutton decision, and saying these are places where the Supreme Court has so narrowly defined disability and set such a high significant standard for how limited you need to be that they feel it undercuts the intent of Congress.
One of the rulings would say if you could be treated with medication or with some kind of device that you would no longer be considered disabled. This amendment changes that.
Right. It specifically says the Sutton decision and a couple of other decisions that were clustered with it specifically said when you think about it, whether or not a person is protected by the act, you would consider mitigating measures. Do they use medication? Do they use assistive devices of some sort? And this act says you will not consider mitigating measures in the decision about whether or not a person is protected, there's a series of secondary decisions that happen in the workplace or in education where mitigating measures may come back into play. So if I want to consider in that same vein as race and gender, should I not discriminate against you, out and out, dyed-in-the-wool exclusion, I don't consider mitigating measures in whether or not you're a person with a disability. Mm-hmm. If you're bipolar and on medication, and I think of you as a bipolar person, the fact that you're on medication doesn't mean I'm not discriminating against you. On the other hand, if your mitigating measures compensate enough for the disability that no accommodation is necessary in that secondary decision, say in the workplace, do I need an adaptive device to accomplish this, or an individual office to avoid distractibility. If I'm using medication or using mitigating measures that address that issue, then the accommodation isn't necessary. One of the misinterpretations by some of the people who are opposed to these amendments are conflating those two or combining those two decisions into one. The other thing that the framers of the amendments have done is they pointed to some positive court decisions, particularly one that's Arline versus Nassau County that was done under the Rehabilitation Act, which is where the ADA originally adopted its definition of disability from, and said that's what we meant when we adopted this definition, not the definition that's evolved under some of these more recent cases.
Businesses complain that it's expensive and it's hard to comply with the ADA, and it will cost jobs and will cost companies and things like that. Has it in 18 years? Has there been any evidence that it's hurt business?
The best statistics out there say that the average cost of an accommodation is $500 to $650. Mm-hmm. There's very little evidence that it has put any business out of business. There's quite a bit of evidence that it has spawned more spending and new products and new folks out there. So I don't know of any hard evidence that says it has been particularly burdensome on business.
It's expanded the workforce more than it has 18 years ago, and businesses have been more willing, whether by carrot or by stick, to consider somebody with a disability to be a part of their team.
It is a complaint-driven law, though. Mm-hmm. So it's statistics are a little difficult in that if people don't complain about what they're encountering, don't pursue it, mm-hmm. those are left uninvestigated.
There's no watchdog agency out there. I mean, you have a compliance officer like you, Scott, who's mm-hmm. monitoring, but there's no ADA agency.
That's correct.
Yeah. And public institutions, public offices have to have ADA compliance officers. Some private corporations do because they have chosen to help manage that process. But it's not a requirement if you're not a state or local agency.
Okay. Let's go to the phones. And Mark, you're on the air. Go ahead, Mark. Hello, Mark. You there?
Hi.
Yes, you're on the air.
Just a couple of things I wanted to correct. Last year, the General Assembly in Ohio passed a parity legislation making private insurance the equivalent terms also apply for behavioral health workers. And a similar provision is due up in Medicare amendments in the next 2 weeks in Washington, Olympia Snow's amendment. So parity in terms of private insurance for mental health should not be a problem,
okay.
And it is a relatively recent change.
Thanks for the call, Mark. You see more and more private insurance companies recognizing the need to treat mental health and mental illness.
That's correct, and now they have to in Ohio.
And private insurers has also worked harder with return to work programs, and companies have moved towards an integrated approach to disability benefits. At OSU, that includes working very closely with my office in accommodation issues. But even in private companies, they've done a better job of saying putting people back to work with accommodations is generally more productive and more profitable than not.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. Cortland has been waiting very patiently. Go ahead, Cortland.
Hi. One of the things that when we talk about disabilities and so forth, one of the things that keeps coming up, you know, you hear in the media and so forth over and over again is the issue of autism. And because it hasn't been clearly defined, I mean, at least from a medical standpoint, whether it's a neurodevelopmental disorder, and at least there's some debate about what causes it, whether it's genetic or whether, you know, what the different causes are. And it seems to be a larger and larger debate, especially as more and more children are being diagnosed and even adults later in life being diagnosed. And it seems like it's just going to put a huge taxing on the system. And I wondered what your guests knew about any plans for taking care of that kind of thing, especially in the context of the ADA, where if you can't really clearly define the disability as to what it is and what causes it, how do you enforce taking care of these people?
Great.
Well, one of the goals of the ADA amendments is to ensure that anyone with a disability, even if it's not particularly well defined, has one set of protections, and that's from out-and-out exclusion and discrimination. And that's really the focus of the amendments rather than on the are you qualified and what is a reasonable accommodation to participate, say, in OSU's educational programs or as an employee at OSU. I think in terms of the second part of that definition of that protection, reasonable accommodations is at the heart of what the caller is getting at. Mm-hmm. And there, diagnosis is less important. Knowing the origins and the etiology of a condition are secondary to knowing that there's a condition there that impacts the individual in ways and that there's an intersection between those impacts and the work expectations or the classroom expectations that you look at and say, how can we reasonably modify those without undercutting the essential goal of the class or the reason you have the job there in the first place? How can you accommodate that individual to do that same job differently but do that same job?
Okay. Well, I mean, have you either of you heard about – I mean, are you working with or concerned about this tremendous influx of
just the number of autism diagnoses?
Oh, absolutely. I think the bigger picture for us, though, many of us as advocates for people with disabilities, is that we want to get away from that diagnosis piece and provide supports and services based on need.
Yeah.
Certainly within the autism spectrum, there's a wide range of abilities, just like there are with any disability. So if we were providing supports and services based on a need as opposed to a diagnosis, I think that might help things along a little bit too.
Yes, and it's never as simple as saying, well, it's an increase in diagnosis or an increase in some reason for the incidence of autism. But in part, I think, seeing more students coming to OSU who have autism, seeing more employees entering the workplace who have autism is one of the things that say the ADA has been effective. We've kind of expanded the circle of who we recognize as having rights to participate in society. It was easy to start incorporating folks who were in wheelchairs and then folks with sensory disabilities. And as we move kind of further away from the obvious realities and the more commonly recognized disabilities historically, I think that's a sign that the ADA is being effective. And there are a lot of challenges there. There will be a lot of challenges to the different profile that returning veterans will have than from previous wars. A war fought primarily with explosive devices creates a different profile of disability in the returning vets that are going to be a challenge in the same way. Building systems to accommodate a different set of needs always takes some adjustment time.
Okay. 292-8513. We have about 10 minutes left with our guests, Sue Hetrick, co-chair of the Ohio Disability Vote Coalition, and Scott Listener, Ohio State University's Americans with Disability Act coordinator. Lawrence, you are on the air on WOSU 820. Go ahead, Lawrence.
Hello. Thank you very much for taking my call, and thank you to the guests for the good work that they're doing. I'm calling about a few different things. I'll talk quickly. I was wondering if there could be some effort put in so that religious institutions would be covered under this. That's one question. And also my other question is that the disability that I have, thankfully, isn't totally limiting. I'm able to work from my home, but I'm not able to work very well outside of the home because I have chemical sensitivities from a workplace injury where I was teaching and was exposed to some hazardous chemicals accidentally by the employer in the workplace. Ever since then, I've been extremely sensitive to chemicals in people's perfumes, cleaning solvents, new building materials. And I've met more and more people with Gulf War syndrome and other people who've had breathing problems, headaches, nauseousness, the different symptoms that come, dizziness, fatigue from being exposed to perfumes. And it makes it difficult for me to take classes. I would like to take some classes at Ohio State.
Let's get an answer here, Lawrence. He's talking about one of those less evident disabilities.
I heard two questions in what Lawrence said. One was about helping include religious institutions, which the ADA explicitly does not cover religious institutions unless they're doing a if they've gotten a grant from the government and they're doing a food bank or doing that kind of thing. That aspect is covered. There are a couple of organizations, the National Organization of Disability in particular, that has been working really hard to work with religious institutions and help them figure out how to be more accessible, from providing interpreters to ramps and making physical access.
Are religious schools involved in that exemption as well?
Purely religious schools until there are some issues around vouchers and other things.
Let's say a Catholic high school. Do they still have to comply with ADA?
The building would, because it's a place where the public goes.
Okay.
You get a little stickier with the education issues per se, and the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act and also Section 504 of the Rehab Act come into play. So it gets rather convoluted.
Okay. The chemical sensitivity. I mean, a lot of people deal with that. That's a huge workplace issue. Does it rise to the level of a disability?
I think there are certainly instances where it can and other instances where it may not. I think the issue more is than whether or not it's a disability for, you know, I'll be fair, for OSU as a workplace or as an educational institution, is trying to get our arms around controlling the variety and range of things we would have to be able to control and individuals we'd have to be able to control to be able to effectively make that work. And while we will try, there are limits to how much we can control what individuals show up on campus wearing and those kinds of things.
In a lecture hall of 400 people, it's tough to say no perfume.
Right. One of the things that I think will help that in the long run, particularly for the aspects that are more about building materials and that will reduce some of that exposure, is as everyone is being more committed to green and sustainable architecture. I think that in a variety of ways helps access, from chemical sensitivity to good construction is flexible and means more space and easier to make physical access decisions. The other thing I would encourage the caller to look into might be the variety of distance learning programs that are now possible to participate in and get degrees through that didn't exist before. Mm-hmm. And with current technology, which can be very accessible and also very interactive, it's not like the old correspondence courses.
Okay. We have one more phone call. Laura, you're on the air. Go ahead, Laura.
Yes. Hi, Fred. Thanks so much. I'm an occupational therapist, and I also happen to have a hand disability and very small children. And when I was living in Massachusetts, I qualified for a handicap placard. And it's my understanding that in Ohio, to be able to qualify for a handicap placard, your physician must certify that the patient is unable to walk, I don't remember the exact distance. But certainly there are people in Ohio who have non-ambulatory affecting disabilities for example, need to park near a store to be able to push a heavy grocery cart or, you know, whatever. And I'm just curious if the speakers have any comments on that particular aspect of, you know, this disability issue.
Okay. Who gets a – how do you qualify for a placard?
Well, the standard certification form does ask whether or not you can walk 200 feet unassisted, and I think that's without rest, and I think that's part of what the caller is referring to. But there is a spot on that form for the doctor to fill out for other reasons that require that placard. So there is some flexibility for the physician to say, here's my patient's need for that placard, and I certify that need. And at that point, my understanding is that the Bureau of Motor Vehicles will be happy to issue a placard.
I know in my son's case, the BMV only required a prescription from the doctor stating why he needed that. So that form didn't even come into play.
Well, they've actually stopped requiring the form, but the questions that were on the form are still part of the kind of the underlying questions they asked the doctor. But there is a wider basis than just that mobility impairment.
Oh, well, thank you. I didn't realize that. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Laura.
Okay, thanks so much.
Just a couple of minutes left here. Our guest, Sue Hetrick, co-chair of the Ohio Disability Vote Coalition, and Scott Listener from Ohio State University. He's the university's ADA coordinator. I mean, that goes to awareness there. I mean, when you see the placard in the car, you see the handicap spot, the disabled parking spot at a shopping mall or a grocery store, you think just people who can't walk. But here's a person who can't carry because of a hand disability, can't carry a small child that distance. So that's why this person should have the placard. That's where the awareness comes in, and people having to know what a disability is. And it's more than just a wheelchair.
Since parking is one of the things I deal with at OSU, I get that phone call fairly frequently. I saw someone get out of their car and walk, and they had a placard. And it could be asthma that causes a distance issue. It could be chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, a variety of reasons for needing that accessible parking.
Correct.
Does the sign, the actual symbol of a person in a wheelchair, it's universally recognized and we know what it is, but does it hurt when it comes to those types of cases?
I don't think so. It's a universal symbol, like you said, and I think most people, if nothing else, understand that disability takes on a lot of forms. Mm-hmm. It is more difficult when not a visible disability.
I don't know what picture you would use, but
yeah, I'm gonna liken that to using man and woman and man being the default in grammar. It would have been nice if somebody sometime back in history had thought to do it with a more universally usable word or a more universally symbol that wasn't connected to any particular disability. But I'm not sure at this point it makes much difference at all.
That's what we have. Just about 2 minutes left. Where do you see both of you, where do you see the ADA 18 years from now? Do you see it continuing to change, becoming broader? Is it if this amendment passes, is that going to do us for 18 years?
I think if this amendment passes, that certainly in terms of the definition of disability in the ADA itself, that should do it for 18 years. Mm-hmm. With any new piece of legislation, there'll be a new series of court cases. The goal of the crafters of this amendment is to move those cases from the kind of procedural arguments, are you a person with a disability, do you belong to the protected class, to the more substantive arguments of, is this a reasonable accommodation, mm-hmm. is this a reasonable way to provide access and meet your needs? So there will be some clarifications there, but I think that was the intent in the first place of the ADA.
Sue Hetrick, this all just keeps raising awareness about what a disability is and how we should treat people with disabilities, and that's what your forum is going to try to do this weekend.
Exactly. The forum on both sides, as I said, presenting those policies of the campaigns. I don't think anyone can be running for president or any political position and address the economy, address poverty, address unemployment without addressing disability, since it is the largest minority in the country.
Okay. My guests this hour, Sue Hetrick, co-chair of the Ohio Disability Vote Coalition, and Scott Listener, Ohio State University's ADA coordinator. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
This has been Open Line on WOSU 820, on listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. WOSU 820, NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from the Donald R. Glancy Endowed Fund, a legacy of commitment to great programming on WOSU Public Media.